Hallo und herzlich willkommen zurück bei Inspirierend Anders. Heute zu Gast der wunderbare Marco Dollens. Er war schon oft zu Gast und er ist ja auch viel. Sei es Schauspieler, sei es Pornodarsteller, sei es DJ, sei es Obdachloser. Aber vor allem ist er seit Kindesbeinen eines, nämlich Philosoph. Beziehungsweise er würde sich nie als solch einer bezeichnen, aber er weiß unfassbar viel über die verschiedensten Philosophien. Tauch also heute mit uns ein und erfahre, was Marcos goldene Regel fürs Leben ist. Erhalte unfassbar tiefe Einblicke in sein Wissen zur Philosophie, was seiner Meinung nach das Geheimnis ist, um ein wahrer Philosoph zu werden. Aber erfahre auch seine Erfahrung mit LSD und Ayahuasca in den hohen Bergen von Chile und was wir alle daraus lernen können. Erfahre auch, was optimistischer Nihilismus ist und noch vieles mehr. Aber jetzt, meine Damen und Herren, Marco Dollens. Wenn mehr Menschen über positive Dinge sprechen würden, dann wäre die Welt eine bessere und schönere. Davon bin ich absolut überzeugt. Und dieser Podcast ist mein Versuch, die Welt ein Stückchen besser, ein Stückchen schöner zu machen. Also, teil die Folge gerne und hab ganz viel Spaß. So Marco, we were just going over our both of our experiences with acting
and theater.
When was your first experience? When was the first time you stood on a stage in front of people, or how did you get drawn into acting?
Yeah, I really liked it from when I was a kid. And I would actually in the living room of my grandmother's when I was in Chile, for instance. I would sit on a chair and say, "You remember the character? I'd show her the scene from the movie." And then I'd want to do it. I remember when I was like 13 doing the scene of Al Pacino when he's Scarface sitting in the restaurant saying, "Is this it, Manny? Is this all there is, you know? Huh? We're eating this crap, you know? My tits are hanging down to here, you know?" Anyway, I was doing that when I was 13. And when that came out. But real acting, I actually didn't do much until I got here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to Spain. In the last, five years, I've done like 8 different art, independent films and a couple of long films. One with a Chilean director doing like a film about these young characters. They get mixed up in crime, and I play a drug dealing nightclub owner, and I'm a really bad guy. And basically, they lose the money because they have a friend who's hooked on drugs and takes the stuff and loses it. And then I'm chasing them, and I catch one of them. I torture him. They come to save him. They kill me in the end.
Anyway, how is it to torture someone in a movie?
Well, I couldn't hurt a fly, so but I can seem really bad on camera. So I have this guy nailed. Basically, they don't show me doing it. They basically show him after a few hours that I've been interrogating him as to where they've got the stuff hidden. And I've got him nailed to a table, with his hands nailed to the table. He's just there, and he's just under a light bulb, just sweating and bloody. Yeah. And I'm just going, I really don't want to do this to you, but you're really forcing my hand, I like you. I like you. I don't want to take away that little doll face you have. No. cara de muñeco. Yeah. So my character, I always like bad guys who smile. So mine is always joking around, you remind me of when I was a kid, and I really don't want to hurt you. You're just making me do this. Yeah. You're making me. I don't want to do this. I really like you. I did, like I said, I did one of the most intense theater bits just a couple years ago in Barcelona. And it was called The Good Neighbor. And it's basically just a couple of neighbors in a building. One figures out that the other is an immigrant without papers. And he's working a couple of jobs and he's doing this and that. And basically, I'm just an opportunist, sort of a lonely, bad intentioned kind of neighbor. And I finally figure out, hey, I can get this guy to do all kinds of things for me. So that I don't, you know, let the authorities know that he's there illegally and working these jobs and get him into trouble. So basically the whole scene is just me walking into a cafe where this guy goes when he's off work to have his drink. And I just go and say, hey, you know, we see each other all the time. You know, we pass each other in the hall. I say hello. You say hello. You know, we could be friends. You know, do you mind if I sit down? And basically, yeah. And I'm just a fucking nightmare of an asshole.
Didn't you play also a role in Casa de Papel or Money Heist?
Yeah, Money Heist. I would love to have played longer on that series. In fact, I spent like a week with the crew and the other actors, just to shoot that one, a couple of scenes, because the outside had to be shot in Tenerife, and they make it look like it's up in the North Sea, you know, near Norway. So they put like blue filters. It's really cold, but actually we were under a hot sun. And the other bit we shot at studios in Madrid. And so for my four lines or whatever I have and the two scenes, basically, I spent like a week with them, hotels, restaurants, and everything. And I got to be kind of friends with Pedro Alonso that plays Berlin.
Berlin.
And he was like saying, hey, man, you should have been here all along. So that was...
Is it on such a prominent set? Because I think Money Heist was when the first series came out, it was pretty popular worldwide, right?
Yeah, really popular. I didn't really know much about it. I haven't been watching series. So when the agent sent me and said, hey, you know, they want you to play a small role in this episode. So I just kind of like looked it up online. I was like, okay, yeah, I've heard of it, but I hadn't really watched. So I just skipped through and watched 10 minutes here and there of a couple of episodes just so I kind of knew what it was about. And, but it was, like being on any big film set, you know, there's just lots of assistants and makeup people and, you know, a whole huge crew of, you know, 30 people doing the lights and sound and, you know, building all these little, cars to do panning shots. And, you know, I mean, it's just, they're like, money is not the object. So they just have everything you could want. Hanging out with the actors, just because I had some lines in one of the scenes, you know, I'm like, well, I'm one of the actors. So, you know, I was being sort of, you know, treated by the crew, just like any of the other
everybody
actors
else
from the series. So yeah. Can I bring you a coffee? And I'm like, sure. Yeah. And, would you like anything to eat with that? And I'm just like, ooh, I could get used to this. But then that would take away from my stoic training, you know.
True, I would have to like, yes.
Relearn how to be a Brahmin. So yeah, that was really a lot of fun. I mean, I thought, man, I could really get used to doing that. Would be great to be on a series like that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, true. How come that you were asked to be part of it? Were you kind of an agency?
They just called the local agencies for somebody, an American actor. I guess they changed it from where the script was and they were looking for an American. And so I've gotten a lot of offers for parts as an American. You know, the last one I did before that in Madrid was for a Movistar series called Other Worlds, Otros Mundos. And in that one, I actually play a pretty intense bunch of scenes where I'm the general who covers up the Roswell, the UFO.
Oh,
so basically,
wow.
I come over to the base, you know, from wherever I am in Texas. And I say, you know, what the hell are you guys doing talking about flying saucers? So I just clean up the whole mess over there at the base, make sure it was a weather balloon and, you know, and all that. And, but basically it was because they were looking for an American actor. And in fact, I spent some weeks training my voice, my accent to being really from Texas. And that was actually pretty hard.
Which is intense.
Yeah. What in the world are you guys thinking about flying discs? You know,
what is your take on on extraterrestrial life or aliens?
Yeah, my take on that is that I have a couple of theories. One is that they are not from somewhere else. They're either a combination of things, like since there is no time, right? I mean, all the future and all the past can somehow coexist, at least in some theoretical physicist minds. So you think, well, maybe us in the far future have figured out how to, you know, move around multidimensionally. So it's actually just us from the future, you know, us examining our, like, you know, just doing little, bringing their class to study, you know, the origins of them or whatever.
But when we would be so much more advanced now, why did we have accidents with our flying saucers?
Yeah, I don't know about the accidents. And besides that, I mean, just think about AI and about drones right now.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think that us in a million years, it's probably they're not even animals anymore. We've already uploaded ourselves into some sort of cloud, like data, iCloud, only it's just us now. We're just in a cloud now. There's no more physical rotting bodies. You know, now we are just in this pristine cloud of energy, right? And we send little drones to places that do things for us. I mean, we don't even really exist as little humanoids anymore. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about us in a million years, Jesus Christ. I mean, I love these ideas about how long the planet's been around, say, what, 4 billion years? And there's possibilities that there's been many advanced civilizations here that it's, you know, whatever is left of them has just become part of the rocks. You would never even know.
Yeah, and that is always what fascinated me about ancient cultures and ancient civilizations, that look at us now and give it 10,000 years.
Right.
What would be our legacy? I mean, how would people know that we existed? Of course, everybody will say, "Yeah, but in 10,000 years, we will know that we existed." But what if something happens to our culture, major strike or whatever, and many things of us get canceled out and deleted and destroyed?
I mean,
how
I
would
think
anybody know?
Well, I think that there's things that might not be go untouched that we've left on the moon, for instance, or some other planet.
Yeah.
We have little rovers that are over there sitting on a couple of planets. You know, who put those there? Which planet did they come from?
Yeah,
maybe Earth, because Earth may have been a million years ago apt for life. And they'll figure out
that
those little bits that are sitting around on other planets were put there by
a Mars rover. Yeah, a Mars rover is clearly not natural.
Yeah, it's just been sitting there collecting dust while we've gone long gone and destroyed. So, I don't know. The other theory I have about that occurred to me is that there's just another much more advanced civilization that has been coexisting here on the planet that is just so much more advanced and like it exists in a multi-dimension. And every time we think we're seeing ghosts or anything like that, we're actually just... You know, it's the way we look at ants. They don't even know that we're standing there above them, looking down at them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there was a million year older civilization that coexisted, that already like bends and melds with dimensions, how the hell would we even perceive them? You know, so now and then there's little blips of them that we go, whoa, what the fuck was that? And actually it's just them. They're around us all the time.
Yeah, true. I had once an interview with a medium. Is it called medium in English also? Like
medium?
A medium, yeah.
Someone medium.
Soothsayer. With the ghost world, so to say.
Yeah.
And she explained it in a way that really not got to me, but it convinced me that she is honest and convinced about what she's talking about. If it's true... Neither of us knows. But she said, like, our physical body here is only, like, for rent. So we're only here to make a certain kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And when we die, our soul and all the non-physical parts, they enter the realm of whatever.
Yeah.
And then we get, like, judged. Did we make the experience we should make? If yes, nice, you can move on to your next experience. If not, well, bad luck, you have to go back and
that
live a life
way
again.
Too much like we've designed the whole thing, and I don't know. I mean, you know, all the Indian and Asian things with karma, and you know, the Buddhists and the Hindus, and the Christians going to heaven, and you know, all, the Judeo-Christian. I actually, I watched something by this German thing called animated show that they call In a Nutshell. What is it? Kurzgesagt?
Kurzgesagt.
Kurzgesagt. where one that I watched was called I clicked on it because of the titles, you know, Optimistic Nihilism. And I was like, and it's by Kurzgesagt. So I thought, man, these guys are like in 10 minutes, they're going to make a funny animation talking about optimistic nihilism. I watched it and he says, halfway through, he says, everything I've said has probably made you very depressed. But look at the bright side. Yeah. And then he basically goes on to give – this is Kurzgesagt's take on it. And we believe that all the beautiful things that we can experience, like just sitting with a friend under the sunlight in on a hillside, that those things are like heaven in themselves. Just that is the whole point. That's it. Mm-hmm. Which actually just touches on so many existentialist ideas about, you know, was it Albert Camus' concept of absurdity? Mm-hmm. Basically, there is no fucking purpose, okay? And when you die, you're probably dead. So why don't you make the best of every little moment every day, you know? Because if you're trying to figure out how you're going to be happy at some point in the future, that's never going to happen. Get used to some level of constant unhappiness.
Yeah.
Also
the other way around, to be over concerned or to live in fantasies about future. What if this happens, then I'm going to react like this or play through, or if I'm king of the world, like in your thoughts, when you sometimes get lost and play through fantasies, or in the past, if you go over certain situations where you maybe fucked up and want to have back the time, that's not benefiting. You're not benefiting from these thoughts oftentimes.
Sure.
And it's only,
and you're not in the present.
Now. You're in the now. The present.
Live now.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only reality at the moment is I'm looking at your face and I'm listening to your voice and I'm responding to you. This is the reality. Everything else that happened up until this point in time is in my imagination. And everything that's going to happen in the future, I can try to imagine, but it's fiction still. This is reality. And the more that you can sit in any given moment and enjoy it to its fullest is when you're really alive. The more you spend worrying about something that was in the past, you're like, you're outside of optimum, you know, living. Optimum living is taking as much into account and enjoying as much. You know, if you take Epicurus, kind of the father of hedonism, you know, pleasure, taking the most pleasure in within the pain that we have.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain hedonism for the listeners? Ganz kurze Unterbrechung. Du weißt, ich schalte keine nervige Werbung hier und versuche auch dir nichts irgendwie zu verkaufen. Die einzige Bitte, die ich habe, ist, dass du mir hilfst, meine Botschaft in die Welt zu tragen, um mehr Menschen ein besseres Leben zu ermöglichen. Und der einzige Weg, das zu tun, ist, wenn du diese Folge mit jemandem teilst und sie bewertest. Du tust mir damit einen riesen Gefallen, aber noch wichtiger, du veränderst vielleicht das Leben von jemandem für immer. Und jetzt zurück zu Marco.
Hedonism, because he explained that the most pleasure for the most people for the longest constancy is what is good, and the most, and pain is bad, pleasure is good. But that is in hedonism is usually connected to instant gratification, and instant gratification is actually has nothing to do with what Epicurus was talking about. His whole idea was to create a life for yourself, which is simple enough, but rich in the things that are important, like friendship, you know, you tending a garden. You know, he had a school where he invited the students to learn how to just live in that little environment where they tended their garden, they spent time with their friends. and they, you know, and they lived in a harmonious setting. Yeah. And he was very revolutionary. He was considered dangerous at that time because of his teachings. Yeah, you know, hey, even the 5th century BC Greece had its totalitarian tendencies. I mean, they killed Socrates, right?
True. Yeah. That's true.
But he says it's complicated. It's much more complex to maintain the maximum amount of pleasure, and for the pleasure, you preoccupied about the pleasure of the people around you. The more they're happy, the better your existence is going to be.
True.
So
yeah.
You're in harmony with the other people, which is in direct opposite of modern capitalistic ambition. Which is basically you need to get over and on top of everybody else around you and get ahead. Getting ahead, you know?
Mm.
Not bringing everybody with you, that's not the idea.
No. But leading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dominating.
Yeah, dominating is a good word for it. How do you, because that would have been my next question. In our society, it's very ambitious driven. So we need to have a certain level of
anxiety.
Anxiety. But also you have to be. Most of the people identify with their jobs. So most of the time, if you get to know someone, one of the first questions after hello, what's your name and how are you, is what you're doing for a living, and that's basically how we oftentimes identify ourselves. So I am a podcaster.
There's a lot of
whatever.
There's a lot of pressure to say who you are. Who are you? You know, you meet somebody. It's like it's even worse in the United States. It's like, what do you do? Well, you know, I talk to you for the moment. You know, what do you do?
If you would answer like that, you would be called a Grinch now. By the teens.
What,
like,
a freak.
What are you talking about?
What a weirdo, man.
Yeah. I wanted to ask is, how can we maybe combine these two things with each other? Like being ambitious, but also caring about the present, wanting to live in the moment, and also wanting to have some success in life. Because there is nothing wrong with having a good job, good company.
Exactly. You basically, you know, living in the moment, but you have to take into account that there is most probably another few minutes into the future. So
probably
what your situation is going to be, if you're going to be able to have dinner or not, is an important thing to consider. You know, if you're going to be able to get some rest and not be too cold or too uncomfortable tonight when you sleep. I mean, you know, these are the things you think about when you're homeless, for instance. But you know, in life, to be ambitious, it doesn't mean that you have to worry about it all the time. If you take some of Marcus Aurelius's ideas about dealing with conflicts or obstacles, you do what is within your power to do. So if you have an ambition, you set things in motion and you work on those things, but don't concern yourself more than is necessary, like just in the right amount, and then let the ball roll. Stress and anxiety and worrying are things that if with a certain amount of work are unnecessary. You know, you do the smartest and best thing you can to set something in motion. If it doesn't work, well, it didn't work. Accept the consequences that you just didn't do it right. And then start it over or do whatever, but don't worry about it. I don't know if that makes sense. I think that's what Stoicism kind of teaches. Like, even if you're in some stressful situation, well, do what you can and just accept whatever is coming your way because you were unable to do whatever it was. But don't add injury to insult, you know, by worrying about it. Sort of like, you know, take the consequences, but don't stress about it.
Yeah. And it's also, I think this is one of the key points of Stoicism, right? To say, hey, there are two things that happen to you during your life. The things you can impact and the things you can't. And the things you can impact is what's going on inside your head. This is the thing you can impact.
Right.
Everything outside you can't impact. You can't impact the weather. You can't impact the behavior of other people. You can't impact if you break your leg. You can prepare, but you can't impact it. You can impact what you're thinking, how you overcome a situation, how your perspective of a certain situation is. If you see it as an obstacle, if you see it as a chance, that is what you can impact, I guess, for stoicism.
I think that's one of the brilliant things about that school of thought is basically how to free. I mean, you're an actor in this world, so you want to do all kinds of things. I mean, the most famous guy was an emperor. I mean, you know, it's not like he was like Diogenes, you know, sitting under a rock somewhere, which is
true. Yeah, he's probably the best
an emperor.
For
I mean, he was the most important guy in the world who was a Stoic, right?
So yeah,
that's always the best kind of example. Like, but you know, there's one thing about that, about what controlling what's going on in your head. It's easier to sort of try to concentrate and think about something than to eliminate thinking about stuff. So if you already have a tendency to worry, for instance, or stress over certain things, how do you stop it? How do you not think about something that you're thinking about? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the more difficult things, because if you're trying to teach somebody to meditate on something, well, you need to put something in their head. But if you need to be a Stoic, you need to stop stressing. It's how to remove things, how to take the clutter away from your mind, you know? Only consider kind of like the importance, kind of like Zen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How do you only think about what's important and leave and get rid of everything else? Kind of like spring cleaning or going into a big warehouse of junk that you've been a hoarder all your life. And the hoarding is all the stress and the worry that's in your brain. And now you need to turn that hoard into a minimalistic environment, your brain.
Yeah, one guy once said to me, turn down the volume and listen.
Mm.
Like, turn down the volume in your head and then listen to what's left. Like, turn down the volume of all the voices who speak to you from outside.
Right.
Turn it down. Take yourself time and listen to what is going on inside your head.
Yeah. You know, kind of like sometimes I joke around about how to return to your caveman, you know? I mean, if you get rid of everything else, there's only like food, sex, and sleep left.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, food, sex, sleep, and fight.
The basic instincts.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Fuck, kill, eat, sleep.
Yeah, reproduce and eat.
Yeah.
Try staying alive and reproduce as much as you can.
Yeah, I noticed once I learned these things, I think about sex and food a lot.
If you turn down your volume, it's basically
I turn down the volume and sex and
I get
and
hungry
food
and a boner. What am I doing now?
When I get tired of thinking about sex and food, I sleep.
Very good. How did you? When did you first come into contact with philosophy, Marco?
I think we might have discussed it in one of the other ones, but I got to New York when I was 14, and my father's, who's a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
And he was just like, I was not a very conversational kid. I was really kind of more introverted, and he would try to engage me, and then he picked up a book that I had sitting there about Bruce Lee. And went through the introduction, and Bruce Lee mentions all these Spinoza and Confucius and Taoism and Zen and all this stuff in the introduction. And so he just brought me a box of books in reference to all these things and said, this guy's your hero, right? You seem to admire him a lot. I noticed that you have this book around. So, well, if these things are very important to him, you might be interested in knowing what was so important to him. And so I was like,
a clever man.
Damn, I started reading from that moment. I mean, there was his talent as a psychiatrist, because he got me like thoroughly reading philosophy before I even read any novels, you know. I started reading them, and I really got hooked. Some were I found tremendously boring and just amazingly complicated unnecessarily somehow. Mm. You know, like Heidegger or Hegel or guys like that that you read – a few pages and you're just like, what? God, that would just drive me insane. That would be like some kind of purgatory, you know? You just have to study one book of Hegel's, or, you know, for eternity or something like that.
tough.
I mean, that would just be a nightmare.
Yeah. And when did you recognize that you maybe were thinking different than other people around you? Because if you take in a certain philosophy, you start thinking and behaving different.
Yeah, you do. I think my exposure to philosophy kind of just went hand in hand and sort of just made me relax about who I already was. I basically had been already, by the time I got to New York and after that, I took my books with me and I ended up in that school in sort of a reformatory in Northern California. And I had my box of books that I came from New York with. And I spent a lot of time, man, and getting new books and reading. And it just, you know, having lived like already in like multiple cities, living with different people, my father, my grandmother in South America, and being in trouble a lot, whereas like I was being sort of rejected more because I was just not doing what I was supposed to do. You know, I'd be like, yeah, I'm supposed to go to school, but I'd go sit in a park with my book, go and join a gym, you know, and go work out. I would just go do whatever I felt like doing. And I was completely comfortable with whatever the consequences were. Uh-huh. And somehow, like when I was exposed to Nietzsche, I was like, yeah, I like this philosophy because it actually justifies the way I already am.
I can feel that.
Yeah. Where I was just like, you know, all these rules that are being set on me, this is not my fault. I didn't even ask to be here. And if I'm going to decide to not follow the rules, all I have to do is accept the consequences. Yeah. So what's the problem?
Is that what Nietzsche is basically saying?
Well, I think from the bit I know, like Zarathustra, thus spake Zarathustra, beyond good and evil, he's basically trying to break you away from these slave mentality ethics and morals from, you know, given to you by the church and things like that, this herd mentality, to somehow awaken yourself to decide for yourself. Once you know what's right and wrong for yourself, you don't need somebody to tell you. And it's kind of like entering, I guess there's a correlation, I think, between Nietzsche's stuff and many other philosophers like the Buddha. Uh-huh. Zoroaster, in fact, which he used for Thus Spake Zarathustra. He based it on some ideas from Zoroaster. And Zoroastrianism, I guess, it's kind of like that the creation is happening now in the process. And there's like an eternal friction between good and evil, but it's actually playing out now. It's not like the things have been created in the past, mm-hmm. but they are in the process of being created. And you are one of the hands of the creation. And so I think that's what Nietzsche really loved about Zoroastrianism. And he brought it in and he discusses that in Thus Spake Zarathustra and Beyond Good and Evil. And I think it's kind of like the allegory of the cave by Plato's, where he's saying, you know, we're trapped looking at just shadow images of what reality is. And you need to step out of the cave and see the actual light. And so it's kind of like entering into the Matrix, you know, in that movie. You know, once you actually see that, you know, that you step outside of the format, which is the slave parameters that have been built around us, and we are convinced that this is reality. That's why when people take a lot of LSD, it's kind of like stepping out of the cave.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden they're, whoa, Jesus Christ, what the hell is this? All the filters drop out where you actually think reality is the map we've put over it instead of what it actually is.
That's what I sometimes heard, and I'm curious what you think about, but these ceremonies like ayahuasca or LSD or, I don't know, MDMA or so, is it really, I don't know what your experiences are with it, but can they be an eye-opener, or is it just...
Oh, I absolutely bullshit. Think so. For me, I experimented a lot with LSD, but I did it in a completely different environment. with a lot of crazy people in LA, you know, and rave parties and after hours clubs, and then just darting around town, just completely out of our minds, you know. But I think that it was some of the most interesting and mind expanding experiences on that you can never change. Once you've seen something, you can't unsee it, you know?
True. What did you see?
Well, you know, just kind of like the raw emotions of things. And all of a sudden you be walking down the street and you just be super aware of everything that's alive versus everything that's sort of cold, stone, steel plants. Mm. All of a sudden a plant will just seem like it's just breathing and it's just there and it's alive. And you're, wow, shit, I've never actually noticed. This thing's alive over here. You know, just the quality of the texture of your surroundings. You know, you can, the way you emotionally sense somebody when they're standing in front of you saying whatever it is they're saying, you just sense them in a different way, like in a, their being somehow glowing there. And, mm-hmm. and you just, this person is alive and there's a soul in there and somehow you're just much more highly aware of it somehow. This is a, the sensation of, well, being very, very much in this instant and just feeling it all very intensely. That's why I think it's a very useful thing, this thing with ayahuasca and LSD. I don't know if they're using LSD for that. Micro dosing, they're doing it for creativity with some.
This
like
is the new shit company. I heard about. Yeah. Like micro dosing.
Which would make sense, you know, if you just took a little tiny bit of LSD. You know, before you're going into a creative, you know, work session, I would imagine it would have to help you.
I'm sure about it. I mean,
what I wanted to say, yeah, one more thing about that is that it's also, it's not an easy thing to take if you are very invested in this reality that we're in. You know, I mean, you are a successful business person with a family and they're sending the kids to the right school and all these things this is the way it is. And it's perfectly normal. You have a much more square mentality about reality. You take a bunch of LSD and you could that's the type of person who might end up in a psychiatric ward because it'll just take apart somehow. It'll just dissolve a lot of these ideas or principles that they just take for granted. You know, if you're perfectly happy.
And also which they build their lives on.
Yeah. In this cubicle where you work and you don't want to know anything about anything else. And then you take something that's going to dissolve the importance of all that. If, like you say, this is your identity. If you're invested in that, your identity exists in that cubicle. Well, it's going to be a very disturbing trip.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. but also an eye-opening one. I mean, closing the eyes to
some people I would like, I meet some people and I'd say, wow, you know, you should really try some LSD sometime. And then I meet other people and I say, well, you should, if anybody ever offer you, don't take any LSD. You know, I mean, I really think that some people are more, they would be much more, it would be more conducive and more productive for them. And some people, I just think it could be very disturbing.
Yeah. Also maybe disturbing also, like getting down or yeah, like throwing your life away when you, I mean, drugs are not easy.
It's like in the Matrix. Remember, yeah. I always love using that one for psychedelics because he's, you know, they decide on who can be woken up. Remember?
They go,
you know, this is a candidate to be awakened because everybody else is living their life and they don't want to be awakened. Everything's, you know, they're happy the way things are. It's the ones who are more philosophical and not completely convinced of the system are the ones that can be woken up a little bit.
Yeah. What did you have other experiences with drugs and some experiences with that? Or LSD. Did you ever do ayahuasca or so?
I did. I've done it a couple of times in northern Chile.
Ah, okay.
In San Pedro de Atacama. And there is also, there is a San Pedro, which is the cactus there. And you usually do it. It's kind of a ritual to go do it in a little valley. It's called the Valley of the Moon. And it's actually just thick with salt crystals. You're up in the highest part of the Andes, you know, maybe close to 4,000 meters.
Wow.
And yeah. And there's not a living thing up there, barely. But San Pedro is kind of like in a little oasis. So it's a little tiny bit that's got plants and a few animals. But you go up and then the rest is like Mars. But that valley in particular is covered with a layer of salt crystals. And so you wait until it's the full moon, that time of the month, and you go up there at night. You see billion stars apart, not as much as when there's no moon, but when the moon is out, it just shines on that whole little valley there.
Beautiful.
That's covered in salt, and it looks white, like snow, but it's salt. And it feels like you're walking on, it would be what it would look like walking on the moon, because it's all white. Up there, and then you take some psychedelics up there, and it's just wacky because you're kind of like in a Salvador Dali painting, you know, in this desert like glowing white magic place. So that's
imagine.
Yeah, it's fantastic up there. I think that's an interesting thing is to do a psychedelic in a place where it's just kind of like you, a barren landscape, and your mind. Very different from most of my experiences have been in a city in the middle of Hollywood or LA at 7-6 in the morning with crazy people around.
A lot of distraction.
So you see angels and demons everywhere, you know, because you see people's real spirit kind of like just shines through. And so dark people are really dark when you're on LSD.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any revelations with ayahuasca?
You see some people, they just seem like angels. You go, what a beautiful person.
Did you have any like any revelations when you took ayahuasca? Because it now sweeps over the big ocean, and you are now allowed in Switzerland or Austria to do ayahuasca ceremonies, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's in a lot of countries you can get it for like therapeutic purposes.
Exactly, because it's often said about ayahuasca that it's like giving you a new perspective on your whole life and changing things for you. So that's why I'm asking, did you have any revelations?
I kind of, all the times I was doing it, I was just kind of going to enjoy myself and have fun. I think, you know, if you're hiking on a trail in the mountains and you're, you know, you're in a philosophical mode to meditate on nature and your life, you will have those types of revelations whether you do to ayahuasca or not. I think so. It's you direct the traffic in your brain where you want it to go. Most of my things have been including, you know, electronic music, and wow, you really kind of go into this just wild dimension of, you know, combining it with interesting lighting and techno music, you know, which is just a whole other dimension, and it is mind expanding, but in kind of a way that might be difficult to describe in words.
Yeah, that's also what many people struggle with who had the experience, to really find like words.
Yeah. You know, you just feel like you're in touch with the vibrations of the atoms and everything.
Yeah, and that is hard to imagine.
The stuff you're made of.
Yeah. Would you say everybody needs to do a psychedelic experience?
I don't know if everybody. I think some, like I said, I think some people are very... It would be much more conducive and productive for some people. And some people, obviously they do it with guided trips and all that. But I don't know what prerequisites and sort of system these people are using to guide their guides. And if they have some parameters where they exclude some people, I imagine they would. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're going to interview somebody and you're going to see their stability, psychological stability before I give you some mind altering substance.
Yeah.
Right.
And change your whole life.
Right. Yeah. Some people become a little bit unstable on caffeine, you know, imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine like the most mind-bending psychedelics, DMT or LSD or ayahuasca or, yeah. I think that they're very interesting for anybody who's open-minded and philosophical and questions things. I think it's a good idea.
What kind of philosopher would you call yourself?
I really don't think of myself as a philosopher, but no. if I had to say, it's kind of a combination of, you know, I like some ideas and I kind of compart with Taoism, you know, this thing about not trying too much, just kind of like going with the flow of things. I take a hodgepodge. I borrow bits from all the different ones, philosophies I like, ideas of Stoicism, Zen, like they apply it in martial arts. I love some of those koans, but basically words are not sufficient to explain our ultimate phenomenon that we are. You know, words are limited. So the koans are basically kind of these open-ended riddles that don't have a solution. You know, what is the sound of one hand clapping, that type of thing. And they give very much importance to action. It's the one Buddhist sort of school that is based on action. I think I find correlations with other ideas in that sense. What is it in Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground? You know, he divides people into ones who like are timid and are living in spiteful people. And then there's the ones who are kind of like living, and they're ones who are actors, action. I think I don't have a real school of thought that is only my philosophy. I love Epicurus and his ideas about pleasure and pain. His ideas about friendship. I think I apply living in the moment as much as possible, making the people around me as happy as possible to be in my company. You know, I love cooking for people and inviting people. And
what would be the top advice you would give people if they ask you, hey, Marco, you know so much about philosophy, so many different kinds and styles and offers.
What is the here or there?
Is there one thing that you say that's a general rule that I just love?
The concept of creating more harmony than conflict. That's a simple one. Be more of a contribution to the people around you than a negative. I mean, that's just like a golden rule. It's like if people are happy to be around you, you create more harmonious people who then create more harmony. I mean, harmony versus conflict. I think that's the main thing. Yeah, Epicurus would be, I think, the father of that idea.
Epicurus, yeah. Nice. When did you, what were the, do you still have these kind of revelations in your everyday life where you say, that's what Epicurus meant with when he said da da da?
Yeah, isn't that the case that I remember having read so many things when I was 14, 15, 16, 17, and they didn't make sense, or they didn't, you know, they made sense intellectually, but you didn't internalize it until some experience reminded you of it. And you were like, oh, wow. You know, yeah. So I think that happens on some level all the time. I'm just constantly reminded of certain concepts in given experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really, I mean, for me, it was...
let me say one more thing. It's like, it really is connecting an experience with a concept. So when you're really young, you can take in all these things. And of course, you can logically understand what it's saying, you know, in some of these books. But until you have an experience where you feel it, you know, then it's kind of internalized. Yeah, you read about
that. Yeah, that is one of the key points also where Stoicism talks a lot about, or where also Epicurus talks a lot about. It's not like, don't sit here and listen to me. You need to go out and do it in place. Live this concept. Don't just talk or write or speak about them. You need to go out, have experiences, real life experiences.
Yes, that's the whole thing. Yeah. It's when you stop talking about it in your head and you just do things.
Yeah. True. You know? For me, it was a few years back, I guess, in 2019, when I first came. Oh, why are this podcast actually? Because one guest recommended one book to me. It was from Ryan Holiday, "The Obstacle Is the Way," which is the first step to Stoicism, so to say.
Oh, really? Obstacle Is the Way. That's an interesting title.
It is, and it totally caught me. It's like I read this book and I was like, is he talking about me? Like that's like I think about things, I never believed people when they said, Luca, you know, you can read 100 books, but why don't you read one book 100 times? And I was like, yeah, there is no such book I would love to read 100 times, to be honest. Yeah. And I always disbelieved them that there is this kind of book. But then I found this book and I was like, I could read this 100 times.
Yeah,
and then I was like, okay, I think this was my first step into philosophy and in this whole concept about changing your mind and really thinking.
A little bit like Marcus Aurelius's Meditations is like that a little bit.
Exactly, yeah. And now I'm using also like a journal every day where I at least put a few thoughts of my past day and today.
That's so good.
A little bit into text format. And I, yeah.
That was my... I've been promising myself also that I would do that more often. I'm usually too busy out there being something.
But it's also good to take a step back sometimes, Marco, and just sit there for 10, 15 minutes. It doesn't have to be every day, but you have to find your style. There is no one style that one fit solution. It's you need totally to do one thing that fits for you. And if it's for you once a week, when you have time, you sit down with your journal and you just write 3 pages.
Yeah.
It's your thing then.
I actually was kicking around with Lotta. You know Lotta. She's been giving me ideas. She thinks I should write. And it's been years now. She always tells me, you got to write something. And some kind of thing about my own adventures and things. And she gave me the idea. This is her idea. She says, hey, you know, you should write them in third person. Like there are all these different personalities you have because you're like, you know. Each one is a different character in the book, and then they end up all together at the end somehow. And different parts of my personality. I make a character out of it and tell some adventures that are my real adventures, but just being in that character.
It sounds
and
like
then they meet somehow in a bar or something.
It sounds like the concept of Fight Club, right?
Right, a little bit. You don't realize that the two guys are the same guy, right?
Yeah. Please.
Yeah, that would be really funny because, you know, I have my, and especially the characters that would be doing bad things, you wouldn't really want most people to know you were kind of like that. Your more criminal side or whatever. So you'd have to have that character. He's the bad guy. And then you have good guys. And all of them are one and the same. I thought that would be an excuse for just telling everything like it really is. You know, as long as I can own it, I'm putting into the third person.
I love the concept. I mean, you can write like six books, and each book contains one story, and at the end there is one big,
like a bar fight or something.
Yeah, survival of the strongest.
I was like, man, you're an asshole. I'm gonna have to come over there and kick your ass.
Yeah. Awesome. Marco, it was a lot of fun talking to you again about philosophy, about aliens, about psychedelics, about you writing your book, or started writing your book when we meet the next time.
Oh, man. Wink, wink. Good. I need like 5 people like needling me and I'll then I feel like I have to do it.
Yeah. Tell the people where can they find you when they want to keep up with the stuff you're doing?
Yeah, you can find me on any social media platform. It's just my name, Marco Dollenz, D-O-L-L-E-N-Z. And basically, I'm lucky that I'm the only person in the world with that name. So you just put it in Google and, you know, Instagram, Facebook, and all these types of things.
Everywhere.
I need to really do, I had a webpage up for my electronic music and things, but I let it fade and it went down. So I'm going to put up a page soon with my stuff.
Okay.
Another thing, you can find me just with my name. Just with my name.
Also,
hey,
Marco,
but it's so much fun to chat with you. We have to do this more often.
Yes.
We should actually take our microphones and go to Switzerland and we just sit around on ayahuasca and do a podcast.
It would be my first psychedelic experience. So maybe when we do the second one, okay? Because I have no idea what's happening.
We could be sitting on a mountaintop with somebody yodeling in the background and we'll just be on ayahuasca going, what?
Sounds like a great experience. Let's keep this in mind. Awesome. Marco, thank you for being here. Guys, thank you for listening again. Stay healthy and be kind to each other and see you next time.
More harmony than conflict.
More harmony than conflict. Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Vielen lieben Dank wieder fürs Einschalten, Leute. Ich hoffe, es hat euch genauso viel Spaß gemacht wie mir diese Folge. Vergesst nicht, dem Kanal zu folgen auf Spotify, auf Apple Podcast, die Glocke zu drücken, damit ihr auch immer auf dem Aktuellsten bleibt und keine spannende Folge mehr verpasst. In dem Sinne, bleibt sauber und seid lieb zueinander.